say goodbye to Lou Reed one more time from the third record. This is the Velvet Underground.
Our next singer is a very, very special guest. We actually are stepping outside tradition and inviting somebody who's not on the air to sing the next song for us. I'm sure you'll be familiar with him. He led a little band called The Velvet Underground. Yes, I'm serious. Lou Reed is in the house. If Lou Reed would please come up to the stage at this moment to sing the next song. Yeah, you guys should start. That's what band leaders do when big celebrities like Lou Reed come to the stage. It's kind of a jazz thing. The band starts playing. Can somebody tell Lou that his song is on? Lou Reed, please ascend to the stage. I did see him here earlier tonight. He was here. Lou? Lou? Lou, come up to the stage, Lou. Kurt was supposed to sing this song tonight, but he had a bit of a personal emergency, so he actually arranged to have Lou Reed come and sing this song tonight right here. And if he would just... Has anybody seen him? If you've seen Lou Reed tonight, will you make some noise? That's a lot of people. That's a lot of people who've seen Lou Reed. Lou. Lou, I'm not fooling around. This isn't funny. If you're trying to get Lou Reed's autograph, could you please let him go so he can come up on stage? This isn't a joke. Lou! Lou! Would you come to me? You come to me. Lou.
Thank you, Andrew and Marie and Neil, for coming in the last minute and making the doggy's tail wag. Thank you, Lou Reed. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU and East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, Rockland County at 91.9 FM and worldwide online at WFMU.org. Stay tuned. Benjamin Walker's Too Much Information is next.
It's just after 6 o'clock and you are listening to WFMU. My name is Benjamin Walker and this is Too Much Information. A very special program today, live in the studio for most of the hour. We have the legislative artist Lori Jo Reynolds. She'll be talking about her work. She's in town for a prize she got this weekend at the Creative Time Summit. And she's one of the amazing individuals behind the TAMS Year 10 campaign. You know, I just don't get inspired by many things, and this is one of the most inspiring projects I've learned about in quite some time. Part art project, part brute force human lobbying. It was a campaign aimed to shut down the TAMS Supermax prison in Illinois, and they did it. So we're going to talk with her in about 10 minutes. But first we have an interview I recorded the other day with the filmmaker Shahan Nujain. She's the director of a new film about the past 2 years of revolutionary struggle in Egypt. The movie is called The Square. It all takes place in Tahrir Square, and it's currently playing at Film Forum here in New York City, but will open in more theaters across the country soon. I asked her where the movie began for her as an Egyptian-American. She's actually made another film in 2007 about a group of Egyptian women called Egypt, We Are Watching You. And she told me that for her, The Square begins in 2010. She was actually on her way to Davos, where she was hoping to record some interviews with some of Egypt's leaders. But then the protests erupted.
Obviously, none of the leaders showed up because the protests on the 25th and on the 26th and then the 28th of January were so huge. So I tried to get back to Egypt as quickly as I could, got back, got my camera confiscated at the airport, drove away from the airport in about 20 minutes outside of the airport on my way home, was stopped by military intelligence. Car was searched. They found a couple of the DVDs from 2007, and not the best thing to find were a DVD written in big letters, Egypt, We're Watching You. They weren't sure who they were dealing with, so they took me in, and I was questioned for about 8 hours. And then, I tried to get rid of a couple of the DVDs at one point in time. I was so scared about what was going to happen to me that I shoved them down this drain. I don't know if you've ever been to a third world country, but in many places there are basically just holes in the ground for a toilet. So I, you know, did the wonderful exercise of trying to get rid of them that way, but was soon joined in the interrogation room by one of the guy that was cleaning the bathrooms, and he was holding this shard of glass in the air. And basically said, you know, look what I found. It was like the movies. My interrogator just sort of looked at me, and I was not able to lie or deny anymore as I'd been doing for the previous many hours. And I think something broke in me at that point where I just said, I came clean. I said, look, I made a film that of incredible women in Egypt that I have great admiration for who are fighting for human rights and freedom of speech, and I'm proud of the film, and I hope you see it, but I don't know what you're going to do to me. And they actually let me go about an hour later. But I think that moment of just stopping the pretending and deciding that I was going to be truthful about how I felt and what I stood for, regardless of the consequences, is a tiny piece of what many people who went down to that square felt, that they just were needed to change their relationship with their future and their country. And so when I got to the square, I found this place that was incredibly inspiring, bursting with energy, filled with people who were talking politics to each other for the first time, Muslim, Christian, different classes, men, women, and all sleeping next to each other in a square. And I just felt like this is a moment in history that I have to start capturing.
And how does this work? In the film, we meet a bunch of folks who are obviously part of the project, both behind and in front of the cameras and protesting in the square. But there's you know, a lot of danger, people even getting killed. And there are a couple of moments in the film where it seems that whoever's holding the camera is in real trouble. And can you talk about who did this filming and how dangerous it was?
Well, this is an incredible part of the story, is that I met my entire crew in the square. Everybody that worked on the film were there anyway as protesters. So I've never worked on a film that has come together in such an organic, beautiful way. I mean, this film is blessed in more ways than I can possibly describe. But part of it was just meeting these incredible people that then became the main crew that made the film. And we had about 4 to 5 cameras in the square over 2.5 years. We met our DP in the square, Mohammed Hamdi, who's a fantastic shooter. And I met Cressida True, who was somebody who shot throughout the film and filmed a lot with her. She introduced me to her boyfriend at the time, Khalid Abdullah, who is now her husband. I don't know whether Khalid knew at the time when he agreed to be filmed that he would be waking up with a camera next to him. And in terms of the sort of the shots that are taken on the front lines and in the middle of the violence, those shots, most of them, were actually taken by Ahmed, the main character of the film, because he learns how to use the camera through the process of filmmaking, and at a certain point decides that it's much more useful for him to be running to the front lines with a camera rather than a rock, because he could upload and be giving evidence. So I'd say about a quarter of the film, and definitely most of the sort of front line intense footage, is shot by Ahmed.
Can you tell us a bit about how you found an ending for the film? Because, you know, you could actually still be filming. Just this morning I heard on the news about the incredible amount of violence that's still taking place in and around the square against the Muslim Brotherhood supporters. Obviously, your film needed to have an end, but can you talk about how you found it?
Well, I think in every film that you make, you're searching for a storyline that, you know, makes sense, and you go into this, you don't know what's going to happen, and you only have the storyline to make yourself feel comfortable that you are, that you actually do have a clue as to a direction you're going, and you can advise and lead a team of filmmakers and say, you know, we actually have an endpoint here. But this film defied most everything, and I think, you know, with this film, and this is really why it had to be the protesters themselves shooting the film, because we had to want to be there anyway, and it was very much living in the moment. It was very reactive. The first time that we allowed ourselves to end the film was with the election of Morsi. And you see the scene in the film, which is now not the end. It's now, you know, maybe 40 minutes before the end, and during the first cut, it was the ending, where our characters are not happy with Morsi, but they feel like, you know, there's this process that is now going forward, a democrat, you know, somewhat of this democratic process. But what happened, and many people, even though they did not like Morsi, felt like, okay, this is a guy that he doesn't represent the old regime, and, you know, let's put our faith in him. Let's put our faith in him that he will continue the process. But literally, maybe 3 weeks, a month afterwards, after he was elected, he started to take dictatorial powers. A few months later, he pushed a constitution through, which was tailored to the Brotherhood and voted on by the Brotherhood. And so we realized, as we were on our way to Sundance with this cut, which represented the political storyline, meaning the bringing down of a president to the election of a new president, we realized that the story was much more complex than that, that really, from the character's perspective, it was about the fight against fascism, whether that fascism was the face of Mubarak or whether it was the military or whether it was the Muslim Brotherhood. So we knew, as we were headed to Sundance, and we were awarded the Audience Award at Sundance, which meant the world to us. And I think that much of the team, you know, got a lot of strength from that in order to be able to continue, because this film was made completely independently and people were operating on fumes. But we knew that we had to continue because this film, we hoped, would be a document that people would look at, you know, 50, 100 years from now. And it was important that we got this story right. So that's why we continued. And I think we're very satisfied with the ending now, because we have now seen a film where you have experienced the revolution live from the ground. You've watched the roller coaster ride of what it actually means to fight for change. And you've seen the ups and downs. And when do you actually, you know, see the Martin Luther King or the Gandhi when they've lost everything and feel like they're completely alone? So you see our characters as they go through those very depressed periods. But the most important of the moments that, you know, you witness in the film are those moments of being extremely depressed and lonely, because it's when they decide to go back the next day and keep fighting that you realize that these people are not going to give up, and it's about the staying power. So we finally found an ending when you see your characters go through this emotional cycle where they have now fought against some of, you know, the three major fascist power forces in the Arab world, which is, you know, a corrupt leadership with Mubarak, a corrupt military, and then a corrupt religious leadership.
The Square, Jahan's Nujain's film, is now playing at Film Forum here in New York City and will be at other theaters soon. Let's check it out. So this is Too Much Information on WFMU. My name is Benjamin Walker, and now joining me in the studio for the rest of the hour is Lori Jo Reynolds, a native of Atlanta, Georgia, an artist, policy advocate, and researcher who has dedicated two decades of work to addressing the negative representations of people in prison. Her legislative art participates and intervenes in government systems with the goal of concrete political change. For the past 8 years, Reynolds has focused on TAMS Correctional Center, the notorious supermax prison in southern Illinois designed for sensory deprivation. In 2007, she collaborated with former and current inmates at TAMS, their families, and other artists to launch TAMS Year 10, a volunteer grassroots legislative campaign seeking to reform or close the prison. And Lori Jo joins us now in the studio. Welcome to WFMU.
Thank you.
I'm so glad you made it here. I met you at a photo show a few months ago and just was blown away by your work. I don't get inspired by many things, and you are one of the most inspiring people I've met in a while now. And you were in town this week to get an award at the Creative Times Summit. It was, congratulations on that.
Thanks.
This was a big a prize, the Lenore Annenberg Prize for Art and Social Change, and you accepted the award with three of your collaborators yesterday on stage. And also another inspiring speech. But let's back up all the way to the beginning. We've got some time here. We'll take some telephone calls later on in the hour too. And you can follow along at WFMU.org on the AccuPlaylist page. We'll have some links to some of the relevant sites that Lori's going to talk about here. So why don't we start at the beginning and tell me how this project TAMS Year 10 begins.
Well, The way back history is that I was part of a group called the Committee to End the Marion Lockdown in the late 90s in Chicago, and this group was focused on a federal prison called Marion that really started the whole supermax trend, because they locked down a unit there and had people in complete solitary confinement. And after that, I met a few mothers who had sons in TAMS, and that's really where I got hooked, meeting the mothers and realizing their sons had no human contact. So TAMS was built after that. TAMS Supermax Prison in Southern Illinois was built in 1998. And it was designed with no purpose other than sensory deprivation and to break people down. So it's a it's a prison, a freestanding prison with no options but solitary confinement. There were no communal spaces built into the prison, no classroom, no chapel, no cafeteria, no yard. So people exercised in sort of these little dog pens off the side of their pods. So meeting some of those mothers and hearing how it affected them to have their sons there, and also just hearing how their sons were existing, completely blew my mind. I could not believe that we, the people of Illinois, built a prison for that purpose. So 1 year turned into two, turned into three, and I still knew these moms. And there were people, there was a group called the TAMS Committee that was, some of the moms, you know, were kind of writing letters to the guys and sending Christmas cards. And so I stuck around with them for a few years. And then a group of artists in 2006 started something called the TAMS Poetry Committee. And so we sent a poem to every single person in TAMS Supermax.
And how many prisoners are there at this point?
It's varied over the years, but it's usually been a consistent number of about 280.
Okay. And if you could just talk a little bit more about who these men are, because, you know, as far as the media representations are, Americans are always mm-hmm. told that these are the worst of the worst. I mean, similar to the debates you would hear about, you know, the high security needs for terrorism suspects after, you know, during the war on terror. It seemed that there was very, very much that language, but there was a moment in the late 90s where, like, the whole country was rolling up its sleeves, ready to spend bazillions of dollars to deal with the worst of the worst.
That's exactly right. There were media depictions all the time about these inner city super predators, these, you know, uncontrollable, even juvenile super predators. There's nothing you could do with them except lock them away forever. And states, there's no, you know, shortage of money to do whatever it takes to keep them secure and say, you know, keep them away from everyone else. And that was a, you know, part of the rhetoric that drove sentences up and three strikes you're out and the building of supermax prisons. And believing that is what kind of allowed people to make this horrible mistake of building all these supermax prisons. So what was your question?
Well, I was wondering if you could just...
Oh, who's there? Yeah. Well, you know, solitary confinement around the country varies who's there and why, et cetera. But talking about TAM Supermax Prison in particular, you know, they always say that the worst of the worst are there, but it's often really, if you look at who's there, it's often the weakest of the weak. It's people who have serious mental illnesses, tend to go in segregation and solitary confinement at a higher rate than other people because they're in a paramilitary environment in prison where they have to follow all these rules. And if they don't follow the rules, they get a ticket. And if they get a ticket, you know, if they don't keep in line, they get tickets. Their tickets add up. They end up in segregation. Then in segregation, their mental illness gets worse because then they're out of contact with other people. And so their behavior gets worse. And it gets worse and worse and worse, and then they end up in a supermax prison. So there's some people in TAM Supermax that were like that. And, you know, by their behavior getting worse, I mean they might throw feces, resist guards, you know, a number of different things. So that's one kind of, like, category of people that were there. Then there's also guys that were there who filed a lot of lawsuits. And so they were sent there for retaliation for fun. They're just basically people who are a lot of trouble. And if somebody's filing a lot of lawsuits and being a big pain in the prison, those people, the wardens tend to send to supermax prisons. Mm-hmm. There's a really great advocate in Illinois who describes who went to TAMS as a game of hearts, where all the wardens got to pick their worst cards and send them there, just whoever they couldn't deal with, you know. But in Illinois, it's different in every state, the dynamic and, you know, everything. But in Illinois, they also sent a lot of guys there who had been leaders in gangs or gang members. Of course, you know, a majority of the people in Illinois prisons are members of a gang or were members of a gang. But they sent a lot of these guys, and, you know, they had been leaders, you know, decades before they got sent there. So, you know, they also sent a lot of guys there who did something. You know, the concept behind TAMS was to send people there who were disruptive or violent in the regular prison system, to send them there and break them down. So they did send people there who had been disruptive, although more than half of them didn't have anything on the record like that. But some people did. The thing is, they were disruptive like 10 years before they got sent to TAMS. You know, so by the time they opened it, they had to use it.
Wow. And let's talk a little bit about, before we get into some of the projects, you know, that you did, a little bit more for people, because, again, you know, most of our media representations about what goes on in a supermax prison, or what it might even look like, or what the punishments are very, you know, very concrete in that they are often wrong. So can you maybe talk a little bit more about what some of the men that you've met actually dealt with in some of the conditions, especially the solitary, the effects both physically and mentally?
Well, you know, at TAM Supermax, the effects on people ranged, and it ranges in solitary all across our country, but most people who spend a long time in solitary confinement will start to have some of these symptoms like memory loss, inability to sleep, paranoia, sometimes hallucinations, sometimes psychosis. A certain percentage of people in solitary confinement will have compulsion to suicide. Yeah. They'll start self-mutilating. Both, you know, a lot of the guys describe people howling at night, people hitting their head against the bars. People often say they can't read anymore because they can't even... they cannot concentrate anymore. They sort of, their mind slips away. They cannot remember what they just read, so they sort of lose the ability to read. And, you know, I always accepted that this was true, but I really started to understand it later when I heard the testimony of more psychiatrists, et cetera, about the issue of solitary confinement. And what they say is that being in relation to another person, both with your senses, smelling, touching, you know, seeing, hearing another person, and talking to another person, like intellectually, both of those things are physiological needs because it sets up reference points for your brain that come back to you. You know, you need reference points to kind of have an identity, to know what you are, to know who you are. And I mean, that kind of makes sense in a social way. Like I can say, should I send this email or is this too insane? You know, I can say that to someone. I mean, we balance ourselves out. And people with mental illness actually need that very strongly, you know, that sense of support to kind of, you know, stay in reality and stay out of psychosis. But we all need it. And when you lose that, when you no longer have reference points, you're not bound, your eyeballs aren't hitting any other eyeballs, you're not, you're talking, but it's very distorted because if you, you know, these guys are yelling down a hallway, there's only 10 guys on a pod, and it's just, and I've been in TAMS and seen these guys cell front, you know, it's like everything is so distorted and weird when you talk because it's all just metal.
And concrete,
yeah. When you start to do that, people lose reference points, and that's where your mind starts to slip. And it makes sense, you know. I mean,
yeah, you know, you accepted the award yesterday with a few of your collaborators, and you introduced me to them. And one of them I recorded yesterday a bit. Maybe we should play that now. This is Daryl. We want to introduce him real quick?
Sure. It's hard to introduce him. It's hard to do a short introduction for Daryl, but Daryl was actually tortured into a murder confession in Chicago about 26 years ago as part of we had a torture ring by the Chicago police. They tortured about 200 African-American men, and it's taken decades to sort that out, and there's not justice yet. It's still being sorted out. Daryl was one of those guys, so that's why he was in prison. But anyway, after 24 years, he had his conviction overturned. He spent the last 9 years of his sentence in TAMS Supermax in isolation.
Yeah, and here's a little bit of him talking about that.
It was times in there when Daryl Cannon would wake up in the middle of the night sweating. My nerves was so shot where my hands were shaking, and I laid on the concrete floor. A TAMS Supermax was always cold, winter, summer, fall. Recycled air that they have, there are no windows that you can open, so it's always cold. It was times that my nerves got so bad that I was borderline losing my mind. And I just laid on the floor in just my shorts, and I stretched out as if I was on the cross or something. And I would lay in that position until the coldness of that concrete would bring my body temperature down. Then I was able to get up, go to the sink, throw some water on my face, and then go back to bed. That is a feeling that I never, and I pray that I never experience again, because you're on borderline, make no mistakes about that, about almost in losing your mind. And, you know, it wasn't a piece of cake at all. In fact, I contracted hepatitis of the liver while in Tams because I drank contaminated water. I had no other choice. I had to do that or else my kidneys would have shut down. And because of that, I've had to take special medication in being home to help my viral load, which detects how bad your liver is, to get my viral load under control. That wasn't easy. The medicine that they gave me is medicine that would make you sick. You will have weight loss, sweats, shakes, the whole works. So you see, I did in fact suffer, and I continue to have different little changes that I have to go through. But praise be to God, my health is much better now than it was while I was in TAM. I had no intentions of being broken. The same way I walked into TAM Supermax upright, I intended to walk out of there upright, you know, in my right state of mind, not having any of the ills that exist with the guys who have been there a year, 2 years, 3 years. You know, the spirit of my mother and my grandmother is embodied in me. And those two ladies ran our household. The men were there, but those ladies ran the household, and I happened to be the baby of the family. You know, so I was able to experience and see the strength in those women. And those two women are deceased, and their spirits have been embodied in me to ensure that Daryl Cannon would be one stubborn son of a gun that you would not break.
So here's the question I have for you. It seems that, and this is not, there are probably many men like yourself who get out of there and they never want to think about this again. Right. And this is not saying there's something wrong with their character, because I could see why that would be a natural and smart response.
Yes.
You are staying in it. You are really dedicated. You've been working on this project. You seem really committed to staying on top of it, like almost reliving it. Why? Why?
I do relive it, and it's painful every time I relive it. Matter of fact, my stomach, normally I would have my Pepto-Bismol right here with me now, you know, to take my Pepto, because every time I relive this ordeal, my internal system is bad. But Daryl Cannon feels that God had a purpose for allowing me to survive 9 years of hell in Tams. You know, my mother and my grandmother was with me to help me for a reason. And that reason is there are tons of people throughout the United States who need a Daryl Cannon to speak about the atrocities that happened in Tams. I feel that it's my duty, it's my job to be the spokesman for all of those who are not able to speak for themselves. And that is exactly what I'm going to do, and that is exactly what I'm going to continue to do.
So that's Daryl Cannon. And I think that sentiment that he ends there, Laura Jo Reynolds, who is here in the studio with us this evening, is a core part of this project, it seems, for all of you. I'm wondering if you could maybe break this down, because it seems that on the one hand, there's such a public service component to this, just teaching Americans, making people aware of what goes on in these hidden supermax prisons like TAMS in Illinois. But there's also a art project to this, which you started to talk about. So if you want to sort of, as the we left off with you talking about introducing poetry into let's pick it up there.
Okay. Well, first of all, let me say that hearing from Daryl just now, you can see how critical these guys were to this campaign. There would be no campaign if these guys didn't step up and go talk literally hundreds of places, go to hearings, events, talk to press, etc., about their experiences. And so having said that, let's go back to the story. So we wrote poetry, or we didn't write it. We sent poetry to the men in TAMS, and they sent poetry back, some of them. And or they said they didn't like the poetry, some of them. But we started a dialogue with them. And so they started to talk about TAMS, you know, and what is going on there and the symptoms they were having. And they started asking for help. So one guy actually wrote and said, hey, this poetry is great, but could you please tell the governor what they're doing to us down here? So he, in a sense, and all of them redirected us to what they needed, which was they needed help. They wanted somebody. They were down there. You know, they can't make phone calls. It's 8 hours south of Chicago. They felt completely forgotten and like they were going to die there. And no, there was absolutely nothing happening in terms of advocacy or, you know, doing anything about this prison. And they just said, help. So we started using their letters as testimony, you know, taking testimony out of their letters and taking that to public events. And the important thing we did is actually create a legislative campaign. And that so that's when we launched TAMS Year 10. And TAMS Year 10, the concept was, this is a legislative campaign. The goal is policy change. The goal is either to reform or close the Supermax prison. And it was called TAMS Year 10 because we launched it on the 10-year anniversary of the opening of the Supermax. So it was opened in 1998. TAMS Year 10 was launched in 2008. And we weren't putting this out into the ether. We weren't trying to talk to, you know, just anybody, hey, here's the problem. We were really focusing on decision makers. We were focusing especially on the legislature and saying to them, you need to provide some oversight at this prison. We've had this prison around for 10 years. When these guys were sent there originally in 1998, they were told they only had to be there 1 year. And if they were good and didn't have disciplinary problems, they could leave after a year. Well, 1 year turned into 10 for one third of those men. And for all the rest, you know, it was 8 or 9 or 7 or 6 or 5 years. So
you have the poetry and some of the letters that are coming out that are some of the documentation that you're spreading. But there's also a photo project. And this, to me, is one of the ones that really moved me. This is called Photos from Solitary.
Photo Request from Solitary.
Could you tell us about this one?
Sure. Well, so part of our campaign, of course, was to focus on legislators. But what we need to focus on legislators is other people who care about the men at TAMS Supermax. So we had to do a cultural campaign to direct people to learn about TAMS, care about it, and you know, then be willing to be part of our campaign and contact our legislators. So this is one of the projects that we did. This was both for the men, and it was also, you know, to help spread the word about solitary confinement. So we sent a letter and a form to every man in TAMS and said, we will take a photograph for you of anything you want, real or imagined. You know, just fill out this form and let us know. And so we got these requests back, requests of what they wanted a photograph of. They could have one photograph. And the requests ranged from, you know, a gray and white horse in weather cold enough so you could see his breath, you know, with this particular thing symbolizing, you know, the freedom that's found in nature. I mean, these were incredibly specific requests. Another guy wanted a photo of a woman on a lake fishing with an empty chair next to her that said Free Bird, with a cooler of beer, with a Harley-Davidson in the back, Harley-Davidson there, and then the picture was supposed to be taken from the lake towards the woman, and the woman should be over 40. We were very impressed with that. We had, of course, quite a few requests of different neighborhoods and different streets. So like 63rd and Marshfield facing east at 2 p.m. You know, go out and tell everyone that it's for D-Man. Make sure you get my auntie's house. It's the greenhouse, you know, et cetera.
So there's a link I just want to point out that on the playlist page for today to a gallery where you can see many of these photos. Some of them you had to do like Photoshop with, like the pile of money.
Yes, exactly. One photo request was for my mom with a mansion, with a pile of money in the front of the mansion and a Hummer. And he sent us a photograph of his mother in order to take this picture. I don't know if he even knows what Photoshop is, but hey, we said anything. So he sent us a photo of his mother. And the wonderful artist Janine Olson Photoshopped this picture together. And you should look at it. It's a very vibrant photograph of a mansion. And this mother's in the foreground, and she's really young, and she's wearing a jersey, and she looks tough, and there's money on the ground. And it's really a fantastic photo. This guy, we learned later from letters that he sent later, that his mom had died while he was in TAMS. And that it had been just devastating to him. And so this was sort of a memorial to her, kind of a way to combine what she should have had with, you know, all in a photograph. And in fact, now that I'm on the topic, quite a few of the guys we work with, their mothers died while they were in TAMS. And it's, they say, a form of anguish like no other to to have to grieve in isolation your mother's death, you know? And in fact, both Akeem and Daryl, who we'll hear from Akeem later, but Daryl, both of their mothers died while they were in TAMS.
Let's actually hear from Akeem now. Our guest today on the program is Lori Jo Reynolds, a legislative artist, and we're going to talk about what that means and what the accomplishments of this campaign are in a moment. We'll take some calls as well, 201-209-9368. But first, let's hear from Akeem, one of the other amazing individuals working with Lori Jo Reynolds on this project. He was also in town this weekend to speak at the Creative Times Summit when they accepted their award for the prize for art and social change. But I asked him specifically about the power of art, not just, you know, about the poems, because he was there when he was getting poems sent to him, and that's where he starts off here. So let's hear this.
When TAMS Your Teen campaign kicked in and sent me my first poem, I was still behind the bars in TAMS. I ain't gonna lie to you, I was like anybody else, man, send me a poem, send me a money order. That's what I need, you know what I'm saying? And so, again, I took that attitude for about a half a day. But that night when guys started exchanging those poems, reading them over the gallery, it was absolute quiet. You saw the best of the best, the means of the means, you know, putting emphasis on their words as they read, poetic expressions. And to take it one step further, once I was liberated, you know, they had started a literal art campaign where they was sending pictures, receiving them from the prison, as well as sending them to the prison. And I promise you, you have some of the greatest artists that this world has ever seen behind bars. I remember one picture that's indelible in my mind. This Latino guy had drew a picture, and the message he was trying to get about was that this system, this cell, this situation is consuming me. And the picture was there. He was standing there behind bars in 3D. You saw one of his bodies, one of his legs had actually became the bars. You know, his arm, you know what I'm saying, reached out and it took on the shape of the toilet. And so half of his body was part of the cell. Another part was a human being. And that's indelible in my mind about how this guy had literally taken on the personality of the cell. I remember also being free how they had an auction and they had taken pictures from the guys who had sent photos to your campaign. And it was like, my God, these guys did this art? I mean, to literally take, they didn't have real colors. They took, you know what I'm saying, like the color from your underwear and a bag of the potato chips came and wetted it and made the little ink, the little red come off that, bled it off, and then to bleed that same color into make their papers color. You know, they didn't have no crayons, no paint, but they found creative ways to bring color to their expressions. And, you know, these same guys who was the rough of the rough, now they was actually, you know, competing and asking for constructive criticism about the pictures they draw, you know, the poems they writing. We even started a TAMS newspaper in prison where guys could submit their poetry or their pictures to the chaplain, and they would actually, you know, put together a TAMS newspaper with these guys. I have a stack of them at home, you know, because the poetry was so profound. The pictures was so, I mean, just mind blowing that I had to collect them. And so yes, I'm a living witness of how art and this so-called legislative art had a hand in transforming these guys, not only their minds, but also their hearts.
Yeah. But even taking it a step further, how influential was the art part of this shutting TAMS down?
It was very, very, very influential. You know, it was like the perfect storm. You know, you had legislators who was actually reading these poems and viewing these pictures, and tears was welling up in their eyes, you know. And so the poems wasn't about Jack and Jill going up the hill. You know, here I am sitting in this cell, and people try to tell me that I'm living in hell. How are you going to advise me what I'm going through when you don't know, you know what I'm saying, unless it's you? And so just that fast, you know, I'm telling a person about how I'm feeling You know, and the legislators start to feel it. I thank God for Legislator Amos. I thank him for Eddie Washington, Ricky Hendon, Patricia Van Pelt. You know, these people was moved by these pictures and these verses that they saw and read. And ultimately, they put their pen to the paper to sign off and say closed hands.
Well, there, that is Akeem, one of your collaborators, Laurie Jo Reynolds. And he kind of gave away the amazing part of the story, which is you were successful and TAMS was closed. I want to ask you the same question I asked him there about, like, how influential was the art part of this legislative art project in that success?
Well, you know, I think of the whole campaign as legislative art, not just the photo part. Not just the poetry part, you know, and not just the graphic design part. There's so many different elements. But it's really, I really think of the whole entire campaign as a system that worked together and was incredibly well integrated. Like our graphic design, our photos, we brought our photos to the State House, our special lobbying cards that were designed, yeah, you know, for special purposes. So the entire campaign had this form of commitment and even obsession, you know, that is what to me brings it into the realm of art. And all these things that we're naming are part of it. So, yeah. But, I mean, I feel like this is an issue that nonprofits were not taking up at the time, because it was, as you said, this group that was the most demonized group at the time, you know, yeah, the supermax prisoners, the worst of the worst. And I feel like
and we should point out that the prisons have a lot of money and a lot of power. I mean, this is a lot of big business. You know, it's, we all hear about the prison industrial complex, but if there was the front end, it would be, you know, these high security supermaxes where it's just like bazillions of dollars.
Yeah. Well, and in the end, I mean, we might as well tell the rest of the story here. It was the Guards Union that ended up being our major opponent in the fight to close TAMS, and it was Governor Quinn who ultimately made the decision to do it, and an incredibly courageous, principled decision.
Yeah. But let's talk a little bit more about, I'm totally cool with trying not to separate, I'm sorry if it sounds like I'm trying to pull the art out of the thing. You do call it legislative art. I'm totally cool with that, but could you just maybe talk a little bit more about how you see this working sort of holistically,
yes,
together?
Right. Well, you know, as I said before,
you're the first legislative artist I've,
yeah,
ever met.
Okay.
I have to say.
Yeah. Well, so the idea is that the goal of the art is policy change. You know, if there's political art, it means that there's some political goal, and the goal of the art should be policy change, and that's kind of how we saw it, but. In terms of how it was working, I mean, the different projects that you've talked about, the photo request project, and having the men's poetry and all this other stuff, and actually just hearing the guys talk and give testimony, and we did performances. I mean, we did all kinds of things. Those are the things that grip the attention of the public. And then one of the principles of our campaign was nothing goes out into the ether. We don't have an event just to have an event. So afterwards, we would get every single person to be very goal-oriented about the next thing they did, and we would keep track of that. So we got everyone's name. You know, we literally said, we're not interested in telling you about this if you're not going to do something about it. It doesn't matter how you feel about it. It matters, yeah, what you do about it. So we were very...
Wow. Well, you know, let me just push on that. Like, I think that there are many artists who make something in hope, have grand ambitions and hopes, realistic, unrealistic, that this art will have an effect. I mean, I don't think that that's something unshared. It's just that, again, you know, one of the reasons I'm so happy to have you here in the studio is that you are really inspiring. You pulled this off. And I'm wondering, you know, if you could just tell us a little bit more about, I mean, yeah, like, so picking that up there, you know, what do you mean sort of goal-oriented? Like, is it, you know, you just can't put the project out there? Like, this is part of the project then, is what you're, if I'm understanding you.
Right. Well, I mean, if we just had the photo request from Solitary Project and everyone saw it and said, oh my God, I'm stricken by these requests. I realize that these people are suffering and I want to do something, but then they don't have anything to do. So it doesn't actually, I mean, we're kind of like waiting for their feelings to, yeah, go up and bounce off the moon and come back down and do something. I mean, there's no vehicle for change there. So we actually had a strategic plan, you know, which was to go to legislators, convince them to provide oversight for this prison. We actually studied the three branches of government. Hey, the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch, and realized we had to deal with legislators because the other two, nothing was going to happen at that moment. So we went to the legislators, and they were very concerned, very upset. We had, you know, we kept track of who had which legislator, and we had constituents go to their legislators. The legislators, they cared. They got really involved. They were amazing. And they helped put pressure on the Department of Corrections. And, in fact, we introduced legislation to reform the Supermax. And then that led to, of course, a ton of press, but it also, more importantly, led to a lot of roundtable discussions with the Department of Corrections about just what the hell's going on there. And so we brought the guys in, us, the family members, did our research and had these meetings and really pinned them against the wall. I mean, they couldn't really justify what they were doing.
Sure, sure. You know, you talk about, like, giving people an opportunity to move beyond, I don't care, you know, your feelings. I don't care. I like that. But at the same time, you know, the color line in terms in this country of, like, you know, what groups in this country are primarily in prison, it makes it so much difficult for those who might not know someone in prison. How did you deal with that issue? Like, getting people to come together. I mean, you have some amazing work you did with moms, and we're going to just briefly hear from Brenda, one of your colleagues, here in a minute. But, you know, and there she talks about mothers having, you know, that is a very easy group. What about people who don't have a connection to someone that was behind
bars?
Well,
that's where, I mean, that you answered your own question. That's where the art comes in. I mean, people can hear Akeem, Daryl, these other guys. They can read the testimony and see the photo requests. The photo requests were a huge window for people to care about this, you know, because they it just sort of open your mind to realize, God, there's people in there who can't even see an image.
Yeah.
You know, they can't talk to another person. They don't see anything. So they were very convinced by these guys, you know. And then the people, the men themselves wrote to their family members. That's how we got the names of all the family members. It was a system that worked. You know, we went east side, west side, north side, and got rounded up everyone we could. And it took hundreds of people to do individual acts of calling their legislators, going to meet with them, putting the pressure on, calling the governor. I mean, we had, you know, a zillion different actions, lobby days, events, prayer vigils, you name it.
Well, I asked, can you introduce Brenda? This was the third colleague that you brought with you
this
weekend. Real
this
quick.
This is Brenda Townsend. Her son was in TAMS for 14 years before it closed, and he first went into prison when he was 17 years old. She's been a huge part of our campaign.
Okay, let's just briefly hear from her. I asked her what the lessons of this story should be. This is her answer.
The lesson that the public can learn from my success is to become aware, to care, you know, to take an interest in what's going on with the penal systems. Don't take the words of the prison system or the politicians, but get involved and try to find out for yourself, even if you don't have a loved one in there. Just become involved and just show some loving and caring for these individuals that don't have anybody. Some of them don't have anybody. My son does have me, but some of those inmates, they don't have anybody. And if you can just write letters to them, a letter is like Christmas to them. Just to get a letter or a magazine or any little thing, but just reach out.
I like that she, again, just echoing you there, says it's about doing something. And again, the lesson of this story, and again, which is so inspiring, is that it is possible. Like, you can pull off something, like shutting down a supermax prison. But I want to ask you that, though. Like, for out of this project, you know, and looking forward, what are some of the lessons for you? I mean, did you think all along that you were going to be able to do this?
Absolutely not. I didn't consciously think, oh, this isn't going to work. But, you know, if you had pressed me on, will you even make a single policy change? I probably would have said, I don't know. You know, it wasn't going that well in the beginning. It was one day at a time. But the thing is, one day at a time, the things we were doing were having an effect. So we followed it through 5 years later until Governor Quinn closed TAM Supermax. And, you know, one of the prisoners wrote us, and I just want to quote it really quickly because I think it's exactly right. He said, "To my brothers and sisters by another mother, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for your tireless effort and indefatigable labor. In moving the mountain of the state with nothing but teaspoons and chopsticks and paper clips, you showed that faith alone is enough to move great obstacles when they are only standing upon sandy ground." And that's the thing that's so great. The concept of the Supermax in Illinois was that it was the bedrock of the prison system. And if you take it away, we'll have violence and riots and, you know, mayhem and murders. Everyone said this is the key to our prison system, this supermax. But it was on sandy ground, and we didn't know it. You know, now the Department of Corrections says, oh, there were only 25 guys in there who even needed to be there. You know, and now the Department of Corrections, I mean, we were on the same side as the Department of Corrections all last year. They wanted to close the supermax. And they ended up having to come back and say things that were totally opposite than what they said 5 years before. You know, so I think sometimes we underestimate what we can really do.
Yeah, you know, I want to throw this out to the audience. This went so fast, Lori Jo Reynolds. I mean, obviously, I mean, we could talk about this for another hour. But the number in the studio is 201-209-9368. We have time for maybe one or two questions after mine. But if you want to give us a call now, we can see if we can get you on the air. But mine is, you know, I happen to be a very cynical person, and I just look at the things that I would like to see changed, and it just seems impossible. And I don't think I'm alone in thinking this, especially these last few years. You know, I mean, barely, like, you know, coming out of the Bush years with my sanity like barely intact, and then just, you know, seeing this last 5 years. But I'm what do you feel the lessons are for people who want to believe but just have a hard time doing it?
Well, I guess one lesson is we all have agency, you know? And when you look back at history, there were always forks in the road where something could have gone one way and it could have gone the other way. And what happened depended on what the people did at that moment and how much agency they thought they had. And if you don't believe you have any, you definitely don't have any.
You can't really put it more succinctly than that. So what's next? What is the next legislative art project for you?
Well, we're still all focusing on the men that were in TAMS and trying to advocate for them where they are now, because there's some really dreadful prisons in Illinois. Things are better for the men, but there's, you know, it's still rough times. So we're still focusing on that prison system, but, and we're focusing on helping Governor Quinn get reelected, because he's a great person, a courageous, brave person who closed a supermax, and believe me, it did not help him one bit politically. And that's another lesson. You know, there's a lot of politicians who really are principled people and do the right thing, and he is one of them. So that's what we're working on now. But after that, we have the Honey Bun Comedy Hour, which is a variety show where we're reenacting scenes from prison life and doing it with the interest of showing the Department of Corrections some of their own policies to encourage them to change them.
And these will be live events or videos?
This is going to be performances and videos, and each individual video will be sort of its own mini campaign to change a policy.
Unbelievable. Well, we'll look forward to that. I can't thank you enough for making time to come on the program today. You really are an amazing inspiration, and this project is just mind-bogglingly awesome.
Well, you can see that it was my collaborators and hundreds of other people that made it happen. Yeah. So thanks.
Well, thanks again, and stay tuned for Nardwar, who will be up in a few moments. So you are listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, in Rockland County at 91.9, and online at WFMU.org. Stay tuned for Nardwar up next.
out of sight and the reach of the Walking Dead. Lock your doors, and whatever you do, don't open the window.
They tampered with nature and awakened the dead. Now there's nothing to do but run. For those of you with a taste for zombies and the living dead, comes the ultimate living nightmare, because the dead are alive, and there's no way to stop them now. Don't open the window. A special weekend late show from Filmways, rated R.
Caution. To avoid fainting, keep repeating.
Listening to WFMU, and it's time right now for the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show. And who do we have in the studio right now? Hello, who are you?
They're coming to get you, Nardwar.
You are Roger
Allen.
Hello, Roger Allen. Welcome back to the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show.
Thank you.
Now, Roger, who are you exactly? Please explain to the people. You've been on the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show so many times, I don't even remember how many times you've been on the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show.
This is my 10th time on your show. It's amazing.
Incredible! And today, we are doing Halloween 22. You've been on the show 10 times. How did we come up with Halloween 22? What's going on today on the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show? Halloween 22.
Halloween, I didn't think, I'm surprised by that title, Halloween 22. I thought we came up with so many other titles, but that one's completely new.
Halloween 22 on the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show. Scary music today on the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show in honor of Halloween.
Playing scary music. I've always really loved Halloween. I love horror films and collecting all the toys, and I collect records, and I've got a lot of what would be considered Halloween-type records, so here we are playing them.
And last year, you were on an Ardwar to Human Serviette radio show doing some scary music. What's going to be the difference this time?
The difference this time? The music maybe is a little more obscure, not so what would, maybe would people would consider Halloween music, but it's still haunted music just the same.
And where have you got to find all these songs? Where did you find all these songs?
Where did I find them? Some are from memory, some are from books, some are from blogs, some are from stores, some are from pirated crazy websites that you can only find late at night.
So what did we hear right off the top there? Speaking of stuff people have no idea about, the mainstream Motley Crue!
No one has... Oh, you think people have heard of that band? Yeah, right off the top we heard the intro from Motley Crue's Shout at the Devil record, which I remember very vividly walking home from school holding in grade 6 and thinking, like, how in the world am I going to listen to this, as there was only one record player in our house right in the middle of the living room, and you couldn't get away from that imagery. There was also some Number of the Beast by Iron Maiden in there, some Black Sabbath with a demo of Black Sabbath, and Rain and Blood was in there. And in high school, me and some friends did a lip sync to Rain and Blood that involved some cow's blood, and we got in some trouble for that.
Where'd you get the blood?
We went to a butcher shop and just asked for a bucket of blood.
And how did they give you the bucket of blood? Like, this in an actual bucket, or?
Yeah, an actual bucket of blood, and then we poured it into sandwich bags and put it in our pockets and basically ripped them open in the gymnasium.
That's amazing. People must have gone crazy.
They did go crazy. And at the time, you kind of think as a kid, like, what are all these, you know, these teachers, these grown-ups, what's their problem? But as an adult now, I kind of look back and think, well, maybe dousing ourselves in blood was going a little far, but it was effective. We won. Then we heard some, Slayer, and I remember buying Slayer's Rain and Blood CD back in a small town when small towns still had record stores, and I remember the girl just sort of glaring at me across the counter, staring at the cover, staring at me, wondering, you know, it was almost as if I was trying to buy alcohol. And we ended it there with Celtic Frost. And of course, Celtic Frost are credited as starting the Norwegian black metal scene, as they were heavy influenced by Dark Throne, were heavily influenced by them, both in their attitude, the way they dress, their guitar chords. And Dark Throne's Ablaze in the Northern Sky has a very creepy cover. There's death paint, and this is Halloween, and people love to wear death paint on Halloween. And have you ever heard of the band Gallhammer in Ardwar?
No, I haven't. Please, learn me. Learn me.
Well, Gallhammer are an all-Japanese Hellhammer-inspired band, and they're terrible.
I love the idea, though. It sounds incredible.
It does. And because I brought in this